Okay, page 44, we agnostics. I'm sure that among the people here are people who are quite content with their specific beliefs and their specific religions. And they might look at this and say, this is addressed to agnostics and to atheists. Why do I have to read this? I'm going to give you two reasons. One of them is because in this program, you will meet people like me. And you have a duty, an absolute duty, to make this program available to people like me and not just people like you. So you have to know how to talk to me. And if you have a particular approach to religion or to spirituality that is different from mine, you might not know how to talk to me. And you have a duty. That's what step 12 says. It doesn't say, try to carry this message to compulsive eaters of my own persuasion. It says to carry the message to others. That's number one. Number two is a personal reason, because you will find in this chapter the answer to why, if you believe in a particular kind of deity, it still hasn't worked for you, and you still have a problem. You will find out why. And in finding out why, you will find out why, what the steps do to deal with that problem. That's the suspense I'm sort of building on. It comes towards the end of my talk about we agnostics. But the first thing is, what do agnostics do? I can't tell you how difficult it is for me, who grew up third generation agnostic, third generation sort of non-religious, to read stuff in which the word creator and God is used. How step 12 talks about, it's not step 12, but, trust in a higher power. I don't believe in a higher power of the kind that most people identify as being a higher power. I don't believe in anything or being that pulls puppet strings or does things in this world. Stop. I never have. I never will. And yet, this program works for me as well as it works for other people. And how can that be so if it were true that in some way, shape, or form, the spirituality of this program has nothing to do with the words that are being used in this book or in any other book. But you have to be tolerant if you are of a particular persuasion and, I choose to call my higher power whatever. You will turn people like me off at a point when we're so vulnerable and so easily put off. We come hat in hand, cap in hand, desperate for an answer to the horrible dilemma that we find out. Why can't I stop? What's going on with me? And then I'm suddenly met with, well, you have to believe in X. I don't have to believe in X. This program is clear that I don't have to believe in X. As a matter of fact, it's clear, as we read in the big book, I don't have to believe in anything when I start. Other than that, if it worked for you, maybe it'll work for me. That's all I have to believe in. And so let's talk about this chapter. I studied a lot of philosophy. I've been either lucky or unlucky enough to have done that. And I know all kinds of, what arguments are like and all that. I used to read this and think, this is really cheap philosophy. As a matter of fact, I have a friend who's a philosophy professor, was chair of philosophy department at the college. And even when I explained to him what I thought was brilliant insights, he said, that's cheap philosophy. But anyway, I used to read this and think, this is the poorest written chapter in the big book. Outside of To the Wives, which I think is the poorest written chapter in the big book. Not that it doesn't contain some really good stuff, it's just hard to read. But I began, when I recovered, and I began to sort of study the book and say, if it's this good in all the other places, maybe it's this good in this chapter. I began to sort of understand what the arguments were, and they made a lot more sense. So I'm going to go through them and point out what the arguments are that are pretty good. Let's start off, though, with page 44. In the preceding chapters, you've learned something of alcoholism. We hope we have made clear the distinction between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic. If, when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, that's the mental obsession. Or if, when drinking, you have little control over the amount you take, that's the physical allergy, the craving. you may be, you are probably alcoholic. If that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. Joe and Charlie make a lot of fun of AA. AA has a pamphlet, 44 questions to ask to see if you're an alcoholic. OA has the 15 questions, at least 15 as opposed to 44. Joe and Charlie point out, there are only two. Do you have the allergy of the body or the obsession of the mind? If you have either one or the other, you're probably, if you have both, you are. And in many ways, that speaks to me, and I've been asked to give my elevator speech, and I will when we get to step 12. I think we all owe a duty to figure, I hate the word elevator speech, but it's a nice idea. Within 3 minutes, can you explain what this program is about? I'll do that when I talk about step 12 on Sunday. But I think each one of us has a duty to figure that out. What is it that we say? I think an intergroup would do well, or a region would do well in having a workshop in which someone plays the role of a new person, first meeting, and 10 long timers are put far away so they don't hear what's said previously. They know that they're going to be given this assignment. And to each one of these, as they come out on the stage, the newcomer says, "Oh, that was a great meeting. I felt so at home, but I still don't quite understand what this program is about. I wonder if you could help me explain it. Oh, and I have to catch a bus in 5 minutes." And how do they carry the message? Because we have so much to learn. Each of us has our own message to carry. Like, I'm going to give you my elevator speech, but it's going to be different from yours. It ought to be different from yours because I'm speaking from my experience. But we have to. So here it is in two quick questions is the question. Here's the elevator speech, really. Have you ever had times when you, I got to stop. And have you ever had times when, okay, if that's the case, you're doomed. You know, pretty good. Anyway, they go on. They say, to one who feels he is an atheist or agnostic, the distinction is often argued about, but I would say an atheist is a person who knows there is no God, and an agnostic is a person who knows he'll never know that there is a God, whether there's a God or not. I classify myself in the second. My suspicions are very much on the atheist side. But I know, I've studied enough philosophy to know that I never will know. And some of you, I'm sure, believe that someday I will know. But that's okay. To one who feels he is an atheist or agnostic, such an experience seems impossible. But to continue as he is means disaster, especially if he's an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. To be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live on a spiritual basis are not always easy alternatives to face. And that's so true. And they go on, but I'll go to page 45. The last paragraph of the first paragraph there, the last sentence. Our human resources, as marshaled by the will, were not sufficient. They failed utterly. That's step one. We can't stop once we've started. We can't stop from starting. Vicious circle. Lack of power, that was our dilemma. That's the problem. We have no power. That's powerlessness. It's despair. It's hopelessness. We had to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves. Obviously. If we have no power, we need to find a power greater than ourselves. Obviously, the second shortest sentence in the big book. But where and how were we to find this power? Where is going to be answered in this chapter? How is going to be answered in the succeeding chapters? The answer in the how is the steps. Well, that's exactly what this book is about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. Not which will help you solve your problem, but which will solve your problem. That means we talk about God and all kinds of stuff that's discussed about how its weakness and its we don't believe in God. How can we believe in it? Page 46. Yes, we of agnostic temperament have had these thoughts and experiences. Let us make haste to reassure you. We found that as soon as we were willing and able to lay aside prejudice and express even a willingness to believe in a power greater than ourselves, we commenced to get results, even though it was impossible for any of us to fully define or comprehend that power, which is God. Much to our relief, we discovered we didn't need to consider another's conception of God. Our own conception, however inadequate, was sufficient to make the approach and to effect a contact with him. As soon as we admitted the possible existence of a creative intelligence, spirit of the universe, we began to be possessed of a new power. page 47 is their best attempt at being inclusive. And it's not a terrific attempt. It's their best attempt. When therefore we speak to you of God, we mean your own conception of God. This applies too to other spiritual expressions which you find in this book. Do not let any prejudice you may have against spiritual terms deter you, stop you from honestly asking yourself what they mean to you. At the start, this was all we needed to commence spiritual growth, to put into effect our first conscious relation with God as we understood him. Afterward, we found ourselves accepting many things which then seemed entirely out of reach. That's their saying. They're saying so clearly, we're going to be using terms in this book which you may not like. Don't let prejudice deter you from accepting the concept that it's your idea of what, not of what the terms mean, but your idea of spirituality, which we're looking at. Page 48. The reader may still ask right in the middle why he should believe in a power greater than themselves. We think they're a good reason. Let's have a look at some of them. The big book provides three arguments, basically. And they're pretty good. Even despite what my friend the philosopher says. They're pretty good arguments. They're meaningful to me. The first argument starts in the middle, and it is this. We believe in theories that are based on facts. None of you have ever seen a molecule, let alone an atom. But you don't think it's magic that when we switch an electric light, the light turns on. You would have been thought the devil or a magician or something in the 1800s, let alone the 1900s. And parts of the 1900s, right? No, not the 1800s, the 19th century. You would have thought that it was a trick. But now we have a theory. Electrons move along a conductive wire, and I don't know what they do. I forgot my grade 9 science. But you know what I'm saying, is that we understand that there is a scientific basis, even though we have never seen the constituents of what it is that occur. Right? We don't see electrons going through a copper wire. We see that the wire can get hot, but we don't, you know. So we believe in theories that are based on facts. And the essential argument here is, we have a theory. Work the steps and you will be free of your addiction. And we have a fact. We work the steps and we are free of our addiction. Why don't you believe in us? And that's a simple argument. So I'll go through, that goes on between page 48 and the top of page 51. And you can look at the wording there, but they go on page 50, right in the middle. On one proposition, however, these men and women are strikingly agreed. Every one of them has gained access to and believes in a power greater than himself. That's the theory. This power has in each case accomplished the miraculous, the humanly impossible. That's the fact. Go on, here are thousands of men and women, worldly indeed. They flatly declare that since they have come to believe in a power greater than themselves, step two, to take a certain attitude towards that power, step three, and to do certain simple things, thus steps, there has been a revolutionary change in their way of living and thinking. Again, revolutionary doesn't necessarily mean sudden. In the face of collapse and despair, in the face of the total failure of their human resources, they found that a new power, peace, and happiness and sense of direction flowed into them. This happened soon after they wholeheartedly met a few simple requirements. The steps! Once confused and baffled by the seeming, page 51 now, baffled by the seeming futility of existence, they show the underlying reasons why they were making heavy going of life. Leaving aside the drink question, they tell why living was so unsatisfactory. They show how the change came over them. When many hundreds of people are able to say that the consciousness of the presence of God is today the most important factor of their lives, they present a powerful reason why one should have faith. By the way, you notice it's not when many hundreds of people are able to say that abstinence is today the most important factor of their lives. It's the consciousness of the presence of God. Because once they've become conscious of the presence of their higher power, as I have, my abstinence is taken for granted. I just don't want to eat this stuff. I don't worry about it. That's the neutrality that is promised by this program and by all 12-step programs. That is what millions of people around the world with dozens and hundreds of addictions have experienced through the 12 steps. This freedom from the addiction. the lack of the obsession that sends us back, the ability to be around it and not want it. That's what the 12-step programs do. That's the first argument. Second argument starts in the second paragraph on page 51. And this is sort of a secondary argument, but it really works with people who are logical and scientifically based. The only progress in science has ever been when people question the existing idea and think outside the box, and are willing to accept other ideas into their lives. And it's a willingness to change your beliefs leads to your being able to do things hitherto thought impossible. And they give all kinds of examples, and one of them, they talk about Professor Langley's flying machine. Let me tell you about this. On October the 7th, 1903, he launched a huge 54-foot-long flying machine from a catapult on the Potomac River. The cameras tried to record the moment it fell into the river. He tried again on December the 8th. The rear wing caved in. And a New York Times editorial on December the 10th, 1903, said the following. "We hope that Professor Langley will not put his substantial greatness as a scientist in further peril by continuing to waste his time and the money involved in further airship experiments. Life is short, and he is capable of services to humanity incomparably greater than can be expected to result from trying to fly. For students and investigators of the Langley type, there are more useful employments." On December the 17th, 7 days later, 1903, two bicycle mechanics who didn't read the New York Times flew the first heavier-than-air flying machine. They were willing to think, is it possible? Think outside the box. Columbus, although historians sort of doubt that Columbus was the only person who thought the Earth was round in those days, but clearly this idea that the Earth was flat was prevalent for many people, still is today, evidently among some. And some people said, well, let's try something different. Let's assume the world is round, and let's see if we can go around the world to reach other places. Galileo and Copernicus, for many, many years, it was thought that everything, the stars and the sun, revolved around the Earth. As boats began to go farther away from shore, as distances became shorter in a sense, and it didn't fit the pictures of the night sky. It just didn't make sense. The calculations weren't working as they would if you were only between 5 and 20 miles away from where you were. All kinds of theories were developed. It took someone like Copernicus and Galileo to say, well, wait a minute, what if the sun doesn't revolve the Earth? What if the Earth revolves around the sun? And suddenly it opened up a whole area of understanding. So the big book, page 52, says, we have to ask ourselves, right in the middle, why we shouldn't apply to our human problems this same readiness to change our point of view. If we're scientific, why are we willing to change our point of view? I mean, the agnostic and the atheist clearly are questing people. They're clearly people who think and want to think and question the prevailing religion, They question it. Well, if you have this ability to question, why aren't you willing to question yourself? It turns the argument around on them. We were having trouble with personal relationships. We couldn't control our emotional natures. We were prey to misery and depression. We couldn't make a living. We had a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. Was not a basic solution of these bedevilments more important than whether we should see newsreels of lunar flight? Of course it was. When we saw others solve their problems by a simple reliance upon the spirit of the universe, we had to stop doubting the power of God. Our ideas didn't work, but the God idea did. And they go on and say, you can't be self-sufficient. Logic doesn't help you reach what you need to solve your problem. And page 53, they talk about that. And in the middle it says, when we became alcoholics, crushed by a self-imposed crisis. We cannot postpone our events. Self-imposed. Remember, Bill talked about being a bitter morass of self-pity. Bill didn't let up on, it's our responsibility. It's always our responsibility to deal with the issue. So bitter morass of self-pity and a self-imposed crisis, it's because there is a solution out there. And if we're not seeking it and working towards it, it's our responsibility and our fault. We had to fearlessly face the proposition that either God is everything or else he's nothing. God either is or he isn't, which was our choice to be. They don't talk about we're squarely confronted with a question of faith. Now, those of you who have heard Joe and Charlie will know that Joe and Charlie distinguish between faith and belief. Their distinction is marvelous. The words that they have chosen, they chose faith for the end result and belief for the interim result, don't accord with either any dictionary definition or even consistently with how the big book uses the word faith and belief. But the distinction is really interesting. If I say to you, I know a great mechanic, cheap, does a great job, honest, take your car there, and you go to that mechanic, you're going there, in effect, on spec, on faith, on some belief that my experience will help you. Once the mechanic deals with you, and you know the mechanic is honest and does a great job and is cheap, then you know, and your own experience tells you. Then you can tell someone else. So I think that distinction is fine, but the words that they use aren't. Anyway, they go on. We couldn't duck the issue. Some of us already walked far over the bridge of reason toward the desired shore of faith. The outlines and the promise of the new land had brought luster, polish, like an aura, to tired eyes and fresh courage to flagging spirits. Friendly hands had stretched out in welcome. We were grateful that reason had brought us so far, but somehow we couldn't quite step ashore. Perhaps we had been leaning too heavily on reason that last mile, and we didn't like to lose our support. In the late 1800s, early 1900s, there's a philosopher named Søren Kierkegaard, a Danish philosopher, who developed this idea of the leap of faith, that at a certain point, you have to get rid of reason and leap ashore without knowing what was below you and whether you could reach that shore. Bill did study some philosophy, but Kierkegaard was not well known in the States when he was writing, so I don't know. But this is what he's talking about. You're walking on the bridge of reason. It's taking you to a certain point. Yes, I need what they have. But there's a point at which you've got to make that leap and say, I'm going to try it. I'm going to try it regardless of whether it makes sense to me, because they have what I want. And that's, you know, that's a very powerful image to me. It's, it's the Indiana Jones with Sean Connery, the Temple of Doom, is it? They're running away from the bad guys and they're following these directions and they walk across the bridge of faith and they sort of come out of the mountain. There's suddenly a chasm below them, right? And they say, well, the directions have been right so far. We're going to walk. It turns out to be it's good movie making, but it's absolutely absurd. It turns out to be a camouflage bridge, you know, and as soon as they walk across it, the bridge falls apart and then all the bad guys come and they fall to their doom. Oh, spoiler. And Indiana Jones comes out of it alive. Spoiler. Anyway, so right at the bottom of page 53 comes the third argument. And this is, for me, the killer. We do believe in something. All of us believe in something. If the agnostic and the atheist didn't have any beliefs, why would they care? Somehow, something is important for them to take a position that there is no God, or that there probably isn't a God, or that they won't know whether there's a God. All of us believe in something. They say, without knowing it, hadn't we been brought to where we stood by a certain kind of faith? Page 54, didn't we believe in our own reasoning? Didn't we have confidence in our ability to think? What was that but a sort of faith? That's cheap philosophy, but it's cute. Yes, we have been faithful, abjectly, horribly, or hopelessly faithful to the God of reason. So in one way or another, we discover that faith had been evolved all the time. Now comes the real argument. We found, too, that we had been worshippers. What a state of mental goose flesh that used to bring on. Had we not variously, in various ways, worshipped people, sentiment, things, money, and ourselves? And then with a better motive, had we not worshipfully beheld the sunset, the sea, or the flower? Who of us had not loved something or somebody? How much of these feelings, these loves, these worships have to do with pure reason? Little or nothing, we saw at last. I wish they'd said yet. But yet, were not these things the tissue out of which our lives were constructed? Didn't these feelings, after all, determine the course of our existence? It was impossible to say we had no capacity for faith or love or worship. In one form or another, we've been living by faith and little else. I remember I was privileged to be at the birth of both of my daughters. And I remember my first daughter, she's there, she's a minute old, I'm holding her in her arms. I would die for her. I knew that. I don't know if I said out loud, but I remember saying, I will die for you. She was not worth a thing in the general balance of things compared to me. I was a grown-up adult person who was being of some value to life, and she's a person who needed, turned out, many years of care. But I knew I'd die for her. I know I'd die for my wife. I know I'd die for our other daughter. I know it would be instinctive. It wouldn't even be, I wouldn't think, but I'd do what I could to stand in the way. Of course I would. And most of us have had that feeling in some way, shape, or form. How reasonable is that? It's not reasonable at all. It is the gut. It is what we are made out of. And the big book's point is that all that really makes our lives and motivates us is something that we cannot justify on a reasonable basis. Beauty. I'm sure there are many of us. I'm transported by some music. It absolutely puts me in a different world. The beauty of that music is more, it makes me realize I am nothing compared to what that music is. That music will live forever. I will live for however many years. For me, justice is important. Whatever justice means to me, it's an important thing. And truth, very important for me. I have this inquiring mind. Truth is important. My first sponsor said to me, is there anything that is more important than you? And I said, truth, love, well, it took me a while, but I said, truth, love, justice, and beauty. They are things that I know are more important than I am. I have no idea how courageous I am. I've never had to sort of find out if I would die for them, but I know that they are more important than I am. And the big book says, imagine life without faith, where nothing left but pure reason, it wouldn't be life, but we couldn't prove life in the sense that you can prove a straight line is the shortest distance between two points. Yet there it was. Everything important to us, I'm not quoting now, everything is important to us has nothing to do with reason. My daughter at the age of zero was not more important than I am. I was at that time. By any reasonable measure. But reason had nothing to do with it. You know, King Lear says at one point, oh, reason not the matter. It's just not, it has nothing to do with it. And, you know, I would die for my daughter. As I've said at times, there was a time between the ages of 12 and 15 that I regretted that choice. And I laugh, and I do laugh, because she is the most wonderful person. You know, she's 40, she'll be 40 soon. Just an amazing person, amazing mother. But I would. And I have no choice. I mean, it's not as if I'd reason it through. You know, I admire Mahatma Gandhi very much, and I sort of imagine a situation where I'm at the birth of my daughter, and Mahatma Gandhi says, I've just been sent back from the other world. Either your daughter dies, or I can bring universal peace to mankind. And I would say, my daughter's not going to die. I don't care about universal peace to mankind, you know? So, there's no reason there. It's just this gut. So my sponsor said to me, call that God. I said, that's not God. God is, you know, the guy with the beard. And he said, no, it's your own conception of God. Call it God. And I said, okay. I mean, you know, I think it's in our Just for Today, or maybe somewhere in the 12 and 12. I think it's in Just for Today. This wonderful thing is, oh, I can't be hypocritical. I can't act as if there's a God. Oh, you can lie and cheat. You can steal food. You can pretend that you're happy when you're really sad. But to be hypocritical, oh no, you know. And, you know, that's a pretty good point. So I called that God. And I have to do a lot of translating. That's still my God. That's still my higher power. I have to do a lot of translating. When people say they get direction from God, like step three, I have to sort of reimagine it. Because for most people, that means, who believe in a God of some kind or a spirituality of some kind, a creator of some kind, somehow the direction they're getting is, in a sense, a push from behind. There's scriptures, there's spiritual leaders, circumstances are sort of giving them guidance as to what their higher power wants them to do and to be. I have to imagine it differently. I have to imagine it that there's a compass, 360 degrees. One direction is true north, whatever you want to call it. That's truth, love, justice, and beauty. The other 359 degrees are Laurie's way. And so I'm pulled, not pushed, in a sense. That's the only sort of thing I have to do, but I'm still getting direction. It's a compass. And so my search is to find out how best to live my life according to truth, love, justice, and beauty. Now we're coming to the page where the big book explains why, even though you might believe in God and have prayed to God, it hasn't been working for you. Page 55. Actually, we were fooling ourselves. For deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. Okay? God as I understand God. It may be obscured, blocked off, hidden by calamity, horrible things that happen to us. By pomp, a sense of self-importance, ego. By worship of other things, opinions of other people, money, prestige, power. But in some form or other, it is there. Next paragraph. We finally saw that faith in some kind of God was a part of our makeup, just as much as the feeling we have for a friend. Sometimes we have to search fearlessly, a searching and fearless moral inventory. But he was there. He was as much a fact as we were. We found a great reality deep down within us. In the last analysis, it is only there that he may be found. It was so with us. The image here is of a pipeline. Deep in my heart is everything I believe in. I deeply believe in. Whether that's your individual God that you believe in, or whether it's the abstract concepts of truth, love, justice, and beauty, deep down in my heart, if my faith, my belief, how I want to live my life. Up in my head, there's a screw up. Because my addiction has been screwing up my life, and I can't get out of it. Clearly, I'm not getting direction from my higher power. It's obscured. It's blocked off. The pipeline is blocked. And we'll find out, the image is kept on into step four, that the draino of that the steps are the drain cleaner. That it gets rid of, they get rid of the blockage. That steps 4 through 9 get rid of the blockage between what I deeply believe in and how I live and act and think. And as long as you get rid of the blockage, you will be living according to what you deeply believe in, which will give you sanity. Because there will be no contradiction between how you're living, what you're thinking, what's going on in your life, and what you deeply believe in. And that's the process that step four is all about. Step 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9 is all about. It unblocks the pipeline. And that's true for your God, whether it's a particular kind of God. That's true for my God, whether it's an abstract thought. All that the steps do is keep the channel, is unblock the channel, and steps 10, 11, and 12 keep it unblocked.
What's the channel from into?
The channel is, in a sense, a metaphor, from the heart of belief to the head of action and thinking. And so the answer to why you, if you believe in a particular kind of God and you've prayed to have your addiction removed that hasn't worked, is not that God isn't capable of doing that. It's that you've blocked God off from you. That you're not living according to what you deeply believe in. That was what Frank Buckman discovered. That he had lost the passion. He had lost the pipeline. He had to unblock the pipeline. And you know, that's so simple. It's such a simple picture. And we don't often hear that picture as being that simple. It's not a complicated process. The steps unblock the passageway. And that's why this chapter is so important for you who believe already in some religion or some concept that I don't believe in. Because it tells you why it's not working. You know that image of, you know, I was all the footprints in the sand, I was always there, I was carrying you, and you know, that stuff. It's tough. It's very moving. It's really well written. I don't laugh. I really and truly do not laugh at that stuff. I really don't. Okay. So that's step two. We came to believe, not do believe, we came to believe. It's the promise of hope. Step one is the problem. Step two is the solution. It's not a step you take. As a matter of fact, the word step two isn't found anywhere in this chapter. Because you don't take it. You finally just accept it. You accept, these people have something I want that I know I don't have and that I need. Because step one has convinced me that I'm doomed. And these people used to be like me and they're not like me now. So there's something they have and I'm willing to believe that it's worth trying for. Okay? Now we're on to the chapter, How It Works. And let me find my pieces of paper. Bill had written, the doctor's opinion hadn't yet been written. Bill had written Bill's story, his story. There is a solution, more about alcoholism and we agnostics. And it was time for him to write the directions. And he tells a long story, which I don't think I'm going to read. Oh, yeah, no, I'll read it to you. This is 1939. AA was formed in June of 1935, not when Bill sobered up, but when Bill carried the message to Dr. Bob and Dr. Bob sobered up. Dr. Bob thinks it was June the 10th of 1935. Research indicates it was probably June the 17th of 1935, but who cares except for us big book thumpers? our obsessive, this obsessive group of people who that I'm part of. So the program had evolved. Dr. Bob and Bill found people in Akron, Ohio, who recovered, worked the steps, and Bill went back to Manhattan, to Brooklyn, and he found people and set up groups there. And there were about 100 people. And they had six steps. They didn't have 12, they had six, based on the Oxford groups. As a matter of fact, most of them affiliated with the Oxford groups, and they were called the drunks in the Oxford groups. The Oxford groups didn't like them. You know, these were posh homes that they met in, and the cigarette burns and the cigarette smoke and all the coffee spilled. Guys with, you know, the bums who would come into these posh homes, they weren't all that happy, but that's beside the point. There were also so many people who were so giving and so wonderful. But there were six steps, and they basically came from the Oxford groups and Dr. Silkworth. The first one was, we admitted we were powerless. That's step one. The other five came from the Oxford groups, and I don't have, I wish I had that piece of paper. Bill said, what is this program that you're part of, this Oxford groups? And Abby said, well, you get honest with yourself. You get honest with another human being. You make up for all the harms you've done to others. You pray for guidance in all things. And you help others without regard to power, property, or prestige, unselfishly. That was, in a nutshell, what he got from the Oxford groups. And that was reflected in the next six steps. I can give you three different sources. One is from a book called Bill Wilson, How the AA Message Reached the World. The other is from The Language of the Heart. Do we have Language of the Heart here?
No.
Oh, it's a book of all the essays that Bill wrote for The Grapevine, the equivalent of Our Lifeline. It's a brilliant book. I really recommend it. It's OA-approved literature as well. And the other is from page 263 of the fourth edition and 292 of the third edition. And let's turn to that for the moment because I love this this story. This is the guy who, for a couple of different reasons I like it. This is a guy from Chicago. So 263 in the fourth edition and 292 in the third edition. The story is called He Sold Himself Short. And this was, guy comes from Chicago. He stays with Dr. Bob, spends a month going to different groups. And then it's time for him to do the steps. So he says, the day before I was due to go back to Chicago was Dr. Bob's afternoon off. He had me to the office, and we spent 3 or 4 hours formally going through the six-step program as it was at that time. The six steps were complete deflation, powerless over food, over alcohol. Dependence and guidance from a higher power became step 11, but it was second. Third, moral inventory. Got honest with ourselves. Four, confession. Admitted to other people. Step five. So step four, step five. Got honest with ourselves, got honest with another human being. Restitution, made up for the harms that we had done, step nine. Continued work with other alcoholics, step 12. So, and in the language of the heart, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, step one. We got honest with ourselves, step four. We got honest with another person in confidence, step five. We made amends for harms done others, step nine. We worked with other alcoholics without demand for prestige or money, 12. We prayed to God to help us do these things as best we could, 11. So step one, step four, step five, step nine, step 11, and step 12. Those are the six steps. And you will note that in the big book, those are the steps that are discussed the longest. And that many of the other steps are, they're not dismissed, but they're covered in one or two paragraphs. And this concept that each step requires the same amount of work really stems from originally the AA 12 and 12 and then our OA 12 and 12 that give almost equal number of pages to each one of the steps in their essays. So we sort of think each one has to take the same length of time. But in fact, step four, for most people, is the longest step. And amends, of course, can take a long time. And step 12 takes your lifetime. And step 11 takes your lifetime. Bill talks about how he developed the 12 steps. He's not a happy camper. Everyone is criticizing how he wrote the book, the drafts up to now. And then Bill, this wonderful writer, then has a whole bunch of dangling participles. Anyway, having arrived at chapter 5, it seemed high time to state what our program really was. I remember running over in my mind the word-of-mouth phrases then in current use, jotting these down, they added up to the six that I just read. Then came the idea that our program ought to be more accurately and clearly stated. Distant readers would have to have a precise set of principles. Knowing the alcoholic's ability to rationalize, something airtight would have to be written. We couldn't let the reader wiggle out anywhere. Besides, a more complete statement would help in the chapters to come, where we need to show exactly how it ought to be worked. At length, I began to write on a cheap yellow tablet. I split the word-of-mouth program up into smaller pieces, meanwhile enlarging its scope considerably. Uninspired as I felt, I was surprised that in a short time, perhaps half an hour, I had set down certain principles, which on being counted, turned out to be 12 in number. They were different from what we now have, but that's what he wrote. He liked the idea of 12 apostles, you know, stuff like that. And a lot of people like the number 12. You know, there's certainly a movement within OA to add three more tools, so we'd have 12 tools. And it was just defeated, actually. Some motions came to add three more tools, and they didn't make it past the intergroups. But this guy from Chicago was doing this before the 12 steps are written, so on page 263 or 292 in the third edition. I love this part. That has nothing to do with what I'm just about to talk about, the step three, or how it works, but it has a lot to do with step four. Dr. Bob led me through all these steps. At the moral inventory, he brought up several of my bad personality traits or character defects, such as selfishness, conceit, jealousy, carelessness, intolerance, ill temper, sarcasm, and resentments. We went over these at great length, 3 to 4 hours. And then he finally asked me if I wanted these defects of character removed. When I said yes, we both knelt at his desk and prayed, each of us asking to have these defects taken away. 3 to 4 hours, steps 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8. And we say, you can't do step 4 until you've been abstinent for a year or something like that. I imagine Dr. Bob is saying, you've been awful, haven't you? Yes, Dr. Bob. You know, he was a saint. And I think that's one of the reasons that Bill had to write out the step 4 instructions the way he did, was that Bill couldn't do it the way Dr. Bob did. Dr. Bob was a very imposing man who was saintly, except in how he treated his kids, because they weren't very happy with him for a long time. But he was a saint by almost any measure. And when Dr. Bob would say to you, you've been a terrible person, yes, Dr. Bob. You know, that's how you would react. Bill couldn't say that. You've been a terrible person, so have you. You know, because Bill was a promoter. I mean, Bill was a hustler, and you could hear the hustle in him and all the speeches he ever made. I mean, the joke in AA, I don't know, is that if Bill had had his way, AA would be a multi-million dollar corporation with hospitals and missionaries and all that. And if Dr. Bob had his way, AA would be in Brooklyn, Akron, and Cleveland. It was between them, the humility of Dr. Bob and the sense of duty and carrying the message outside of the small circle that Bill had that created AA as it is today. But just imagine, so, Doctor, you've been this and you've been that. Yes, Dr. Bob. You've done this and you've done that. Yes, Dr. Bob. Do you want God to remove all these defects of character? Yes, Dr. Bob. Get on your knees and let's pray. Yes, Dr. Bob. That's how I watch it. Now, that is what a charismatic person can do for you. And there may be some people in this room who have that charisma. I sure don't. So I can't carry, I can't do that, but Dr. Bob could. So when Bill wrote this, step 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, he had to break it down and make it reasonable for someone who would be reading this in Santa Barbara or Port Winamie. What is it? Winamie. Why me? Why me? Why me? Okay. Why me? Boy, I would read that as why me. You know. Anyway, I mean, if you're reading this and there's no one from AA around you, and there's hope in this book, you need instructions, and that's what the big book. Okay. So, let's go back to how it works. Let's start with this chapter that Bill wrote. Page 58. And Joe and Charlie point out, and so properly, that we see a chapter is called How It Works. We see the 12 steps, and we often begin there. Oh, I'm powerless, and I believe in something. How does it work? And we start at chapter 5, and yet there have been 5 chapters devoted to steps 1 and 2. The doctor's opinion, Bill's story, there is a solution, more about alcoholism, and we agnostics. And every one of those chapters, yeah, has a mixture of steps 1 and 2 in them, different emphases here and there. And yet we often just pass them by and we go to how it works. But if we don't know how desperate we are, and if we don't have a true sense of the hope that's available, then we're not going to treat this program with the seriousness that it deserves. And so emphasizing the hopelessness is truly important. And it's not, well, I mean, I'll be talking about this tomorrow, but, you know, I don't know how many times I have seen newcomers come into the program and people say to them, welcome. In OA, we give you unconditional love. The food isn't the issue. The issue is finding some kind of higher power. We love you unconditionally. We will support you whatever we do. And I have found spiritual fulfillment. And I don't know about you. I know about me and why I came to OA. Mm-hmm. I came to OA because I couldn't stop eating. Mm-hmm. And yet, we don't hear that. I didn't hear for 7 years the analysis that is in the big book about the allergy of the body and the obsession of the mind. Actually, to be fair, I heard it and I rejected it because I believed that all I had to do was eat in moderation once I lost my weight. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's go to Bill. Now, Bill sent out in 1938 400 multi-lith copies, that's the equivalent of photocopies these days, of the book to a number of different people, all the AAers plus doctors and clergy people and, well, I'm sure they were clergy men then, and psychiatrists, psychologists for their comments, authors too, for their, you know, their stylistic things. And I'm sure that some of you find this interesting. There was a final manuscript that was prepared in which that original manuscript had all the changes for the printer, and plus all kinds of notes. I'll just pass this around. These are reproductions of some of the pages in the manuscript, plus some notes that might be of interest, and maybe not. Anyway, the first major change that Bill adopted, and this was on the advice of his own psychiatrist, Dr. Harry Thiebaud, was to stop saying you must and change to we did. He said, so addicts do not want to be told what to do, but they will listen to your experience. I can't tell you how wonderful that suggestion was, because I've read the original manuscript, and it is, it's grating. You must do this, you have to do this. That changes was all over. He also changed the first two pages on page 50 and 59 and changed it slightly in a way that some of us big book thumpers wish they hadn't. So I will read to you the changes of you must, because those are fine, but I'll read to you some of the original changes. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our directions, it used to say. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to the simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They're not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. Bill was asked, why did you put in that depressing statement and provide the rationale for why you can never get the program? Because that's what honesty is. There are people who will never get it. And they have to know that. And anyway. There are those too who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. It's the honesty that's important. And some people cannot be honest with themselves or with the world. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. If you've decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, and we're reminded of that on pages 76 and 79, then you are ready to, they used to say, follow directions. At some of these, we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way. Then it used to say, we doubt if you can. But we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to, I should speak more American, thorough, from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil, nothing, until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. And we often will substitute food for that, right? Alcohol substitute for food. I've never found radishes baffling and cunning. And there's all kinds of food that I'd never find cunning and baffling. I prefer to think of it as my binge foods and my binge eating behaviors. Those are cunning, baffling, and powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. There is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. 11/12 measures avail us nothing. It's all or nothing. We stood at the turning point. It used to say, throw yourself under his protection and care with complete abandon. I'm sure glad they changed that one. Here are the steps which are suggested as a program of recovery. It's not each step is suggested. The whole 12 steps are suggested as a program. It's all or nothing. You can't pick and choose. It's a program. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives have become unmanageable. And note the grammar of this, as proven by the discussion that we had about step one. It's not we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives have become unmanageable. It's not two equal sentences joined by conjunction. There's a dash there, an M dash. And that means that the phrase that our lives have become unmanageable modifies powerless. And I choose to think that powerlessness over alcohol or powerless over binge foods or whatever is a description of the allergy of the body, and the unmanageability is the description of the mental obsession that I cannot manage my alcohol or I cannot manage my binge foods. Not that I can't manage my life. When I joined this program, I was a successful lawyer. I had a loving family. Nothing was going wrong in my life other than I couldn't stop eating. And if I had been told I have to imagine my life was unmanageable, I would have said, my food is unmanageable. I absolutely agree. I'm on my knees about my food. But why do I have to admit my life is unmanageable? Look at the whole discussion of step one in the first five chapters of the book. It's all about you can't stop drinking. Sure, your life may be a mess, but it isn't always a mess. You may be a moderate drinker and still be a real alcoholic. Okay, I'm going to point that out. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care and direction, it used to say, care and direction of God, as we understood him. His original draft didn't have the words as we understood him. The atheists and agnostics made him put that in, and he agreed. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves, admitted to God, to ourselves, and said five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being, the exact nature of our wrong. Six, used to say we're entirely willing that God remove all these defects of character. Seven, oh, I'm glad he changed this one. Humbly on our knees, asked him to remove our shortcomings, holding nothing back. And Dr. Thibault said, they will never accept that. Absolutes like that, never accept that. Made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make complete amends to them all. Made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Now let's just parse. We've got two, which is came to believe with a power greater than ourselves. That's added to the list. Why? If you state the problem in step one, you've got to state the solution in step two. Step three wasn't there, made a decision. And you'll find out what that decision is and how that what that means. I'll talk about that before we break. And then step four is the same. Step five is the same. Step six, seven, and eight have been added. We're entirely ready, a moment in time, I'm ready. Step seven, I'm asking, I'm saying a prayer. We'll see that those are very short. Eight, first of all, you became willing to make amends to everyone. And nine, you only make amends where you won't harm anyone. And that was something, of course, that a sponsor would do. You know, somewhere in one of our pieces of literature, you don't phone your mother and say, I've hated you for the last 25 years. You didn't know that, but I've hated you. Now I love you. Why would you do that? You know, so a sponsor would say, you don't tell your mother that you hated her for 25 years if she didn't know you hated her for 25 years. But without a sponsor, Bill broke it up, 8 and 9. When the discussion comes, it's all put together, 8 and 9 are together. 10, continued to take personal inventory when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. That's something that the Oxford groups took for granted. They always took inventory, but it wasn't in the original steps because the steps only talked about recovery. He added that. Then the prayer, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our contact with God. Conscious hadn't been there. As we understood him, that was added. Praying only for knowledge of his will for us, the power to carry that out. Having had a spiritual experience, it used to say, up until the second printing of the first edition of the big book in 1941, they changed that to awakening to emphasize the idea that it was slow. It was gradual. As the result, please, if you want to do anything that will help the suffering compulsive eater, emphasize the. Don't say as a result. This is the guarantee. The result of the steps is the spiritual awakening which will restore you to the sanity promised in step two. The result, not as a result, not as a result, the result of these steps. If you say this course of action, we try to carry this message to others, especially alcoholics, God change that, and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaim, what an order, I can't go through with it. Do not be discouraged. John tells this other joke, a practical joke that you play on the person who's going to read the 12 steps. The person reads the 12 steps and everyone says, what an order, I can't go through with it, and everyone leaves. No, it's... Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We're not saints. The point is that we're willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter of the agnostic, our personal adventures before and after, it used to say, have been designed to sell you three pertinent ideas. And the next, the ABCs they're called, have been changed slightly, but the changes are not significant. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own life, step one. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism, that's step one, and a beginning of a step two. And three, that God couldn't would if he were sought, step two. You notice that they're just ideas. They're not steps you take, they're just ideas. I am hopeless, there is hope. That's step one, step two. Then it used to say, if you're not convinced, reread this book or throw it away. And I almost wish it continued to say that one. It says, being convinced we were at step three, which is that we decided to turn our will and our life over to God as we understood him. What do we mean to that, and what do we do? And this is what the big book does. It first discusses what it means to turn our will over. It then discusses what it means to turn our life over. It then gives the answer to the question of what we do. To do step three, we say a prayer. That's all we do, because it's only a decision. It's nothing more. It's not a life-changing, it's a life-altering moment because we've made a decision, we've made a commitment. That's all it is. And there are a bunch of jokes I'll tell you relating to the decision. One of them is really well known in most 12-step fellowships. Three frogs are sitting on a branch. Two make the decision to jump off the branch. 5 minutes pass. How many frogs are left? Answer, three. They only made a decision. They didn't do it. There's somewhere in Kansas, guy sitting on his porch. Police car drives up. Get in the car, Frank. There's going to be a flash flood. It's going to go way above the roof of your house. Oh, no. I've placed my reliance upon God. Now God will take care of me. It's up to the second floor, second story. He's looking out the window. A boat comes by. Frank, get in. It's going to get worse. No, I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to God. I'm protected. He's on the roof, hanging by the chimney or the television antenna. A helicopter sends down a ladder. Get in, Frank. That's it. It's going to go higher. No, I've made my decision to turn my will and my life over, and he drowns. He gets to the pearly gates. He pushes his way past St. Peter, wants to talk to the big guy. Where were you? And God says to him, I sent you a police car. I sent you a helicopter. I sent you a boat. What the hell more can I do? A guy falls off a cliff, and just like Sergeant whatever, Clarker, he's hanging on by the air, like Wile E. Coyote, he's hanging on by that proverbial twig that is on the edge of the cliff. You know what I'm talking about, all the cartoons. He's hanging on, he says, God, I've never prayed before, but if there is a God, please help me. I'm here, my son, comes a voice in his head. What? God? Is that? Yes, my son. Oh, God, thank you, thank you. Tell me what to do. Let go of the twig. Pardon me? Let go of the twig, my son. Is there anyone else up there? A man, very devout religious man, is the chair of a board of a charity, a wonderful charity, helps people. He's so happy with it. The director of the place, CEO of the place, steals all the money and runs off. And it's a tragedy. And he'll be able to raise more money, or they'll be able to raise more money. He doesn't have much money himself, but they know within a month or two or 3 months they'll be able to do it. But if they don't have money right away, the place will go belly up. All the staff will be gone. So he decides to pray. He gets on his knees in his bedroom, says, God, I will be praying 16 hours a day for the next week. I'll be eating only bread and water. I'll be praying. It's not for me. It's for this charity. I need to win $100,000 in the lottery that's coming up on Saturday. And I'm not looking for the million or 20 million or whatever. Just 100. I just need two numbers or whatever. I don't play the lottery, so I don't know what it means. And he does this as he's praying and praying and praying. It's Saturday morning. It's a beautiful day outside. Blue sky, just the sun, birds chirping. God, you know, I'm just three more hours, I got to win the lottery. And suddenly, black clouds come into the sky, cover the sky completely. It's an awesome sight because they came from nowhere. And there's lightning, but there's no thunder. There's this silence. The streetlights turn on. It's so dark. It's an awesome sight. And a shaft of light streams onto this man's face. And a voice says, buy a ticket. Now, that's what making a decision is and isn't. You can do everything, but if you don't take the action, it's of no value. And the big book talks about that. I have 10 minutes, so first of all, page 60, We're talking about life. What does it mean to turn our will over? This isn't step three. This is what our decision will, if we follow the decision to take the action necessary, this is what we're looking towards. This is what we will have. First of all, what does it mean to turn our life over? Through the steps, not to step three, but through the steps. Well, the first requirement is we convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. On that basis, we're almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though our motives are good. Even though our motives are good. This is really important to understand because the Big Book is about to use the word selfish in a way that the dictionary doesn't let them. Well, because selfish means you have bad motives. You want things only for yourself and for your own convenience and for your own happiness. But this is not what the Big Book is describing. It includes that, but it could be quite virtuous reasons. You know, I was born in 1945. The Holocaust was over before I was born. And yet I was obsessed with the Holocaust for years and years and years. I didn't want it to have occurred. None of my family was harmed in the Holocaust. My family all came over from Russia in the early 1900s. I didn't personally have anything in it. But I grew up, in the 50s, as a Jew, you are going to have the specter of the Holocaust on you, and I did. I went to Jewish schools, and I had some survivors as teachers and stuff like that. It's a horrible thing that happened. And not just the Jews. I mean, all kinds of other millions of people were killed. My motives were absolutely virtuous in that respect. When my daughter was 8 years old, I wanted her to do well in school so she would have a happy life. My motives were virtuous. On the other hand, when she was 21 and I wanted her to do well in school, I didn't want her living with us. My motives were not as virtuous. So, most people try to live by self-propulsion. Each person is like an actor who wants to run the whole show, is forever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery, and the rest of the players in his own way. If his arrangements would only stay put, we're on page 61. If only people would do as he wished, the show would be great. Everybody, including himself, would be pleased. Life would be wonderful. In trying to make these arrangements, our actor may sometimes be quite virtuous. He may be kind, considerate, patient, and generous, even modest and self-sacrificing. And I want to tell you that outside of my own immediate family, my wife and my children, I would say that before I joined OA, most people would have said of me, except for the modest part, that I was kind and considerate and patient and generous, and even self-sacrificing. Most people would have thought that of me. I'm not sure that was true. But in many, many ways, that's the kind of life my mother, really, and my grandparents and my father trained me to be. Not modest, though. You know that thing, I used to be conceited, but I got over that. Now I'm perfect. On the other hand, he may be mean, egotistical, selfish, and dishonest. But as with most humans, he's more likely to have varied traits. I remember the first time my first sponsor pointed this passage out to me. I remember where I was sitting. I had read it already, but he pointed this out to me. You're an actor, but you want to be the director. You want to be the writer. You want to be the producer of the show. Hit me it just hit me. It's true. As a matter of fact, I wanted to be a director. I want to be a conductor. I have no talent in any of those respects, but that's what I really would have liked to do. I want to be in charge of people and have them do the right things for the benefit of others. And my whole life had been spent that way as a person involved in politics. I wanted people to do the right things for the benefit of others. I lived a privileged life. I was taught that the privilege comes with responsibility, that other people should have the same privileges, should be able to have the same privileges I had. I believe that. But that wasn't getting me anywhere. As a matter of fact, it was killing me. I was eating myself to death because of that. Because life wasn't going my way. And in many respects, my life, my motives for wanting the changes were virtuous. Not all, but in many ways it was virtuous. What usually happens, the show doesn't come off very well. He begins to think life doesn't treat him right. He decides to exert himself more. He becomes, on the next occasion, still more demanding or gracious, as the case may be. Still, the play doesn't suit him. Admitting he may be somewhat at fault, he is sure that other people are more to blame. He becomes angry, indignant, self-pitying. Now notice, those are all different ideas. Many of us, especially in OA, my experience is, become self-pitying. Yeah. Not angry, Oh, I would never be angry. I remember anger. I've never felt anger. Sadness. That's what I feel, but not anger. I couldn't afford to be angry. I was, but I didn't think I was. What is his basic trouble? I wanted to point out, he becomes on the next occasion still more demanding or gracious, as the case may be. Gracious is the manipulative part. Demanding is the very direct part. Many of us try to change people by manipulating them. Wouldn't it be nice if, you know, or what do you want? Or would you want this? Rather than, let's do this, or, you know, but whatever it is, it doesn't matter how we do it. Life isn't going our way, and we either try to change it or we walk away completely giving up and isolating ourselves. What is his basic trouble? Is he not really a self-seeker, even when trying to be kind? Is he not a victim of the delusion that he can rest? Rest means grab. Satisfaction, happiness of this world, if he only manages well? Isn't it evident to all the rest of the players that these are the things he wants? And don't his actions make each of them wish to retaliate, snatching all they can get out of the show? Isn't he even in his best moments a producer of confusion rather than harmony? And they talk about our actor is self-centered, egocentric. They give a number of examples. These examples range from someone whose motives are bad, someone whose motives are good, and in between. Page 62. Selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles, driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity, we step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us, seemingly without provocation, but we invariably always find that at some time in the past we've made decisions based on self, which later place us in a position to be hurt. That last sentence has to be parsed. It has to be discussed. Because some of us would read this and say, oh, so when I was a victim of incest at the age of 7, somehow I did something that, that later placed me in a position to be hurt? Absolutely not. Bill would never have written that. What Charlie says about this is a great example. He said, when I was 8 years old, my father beat me black and blue. No child deserves to be beaten black and blue. But if 50 years later, my father, now dead, is still beating me black and blue, clearly in the past, I have made decisions based on self. My whole life has been changed because of what happened to me, that have placed me in a position to continue to be hurt. Okay? I think it's really important to point that out. And as we go through step 4, I'm going to be giving you the experience, not my experience, the experience of friends of mine who have suffered horrible childhood traumas and adult traumas, and how they use the steps to deal with it. So our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. Some people say it's I, capital I, trouble. They arise out of ourselves, and the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. Above everything, we alcoholics must be rid of this selfishness. Notice selfishness, because selfish here means wanting my way regardless of the motivations. Different from the definition in the dictionary. I want life to be better for other people is selfish from this perspective, because I want to be in charge of life. It's selfish. I want to be in charge of life. We must, or it kills us, and God makes that possible. Let's go on. So this is the how and why of it. First of all, we have to quit playing God. It didn't work. That's turning my will over to God. I can't be in charge. My will has to be gotten rid of. Next, we decided that hereafter in this drama of life, we're turning, what does it mean to turn our life over? God was going to be our director. He's the principal. We're his agents. He's the father. We're his children. He got rid of one sentence. I'm so glad he got rid of this. Get that simple relationship straight. Most good ideas are simple, and this concept was the keystone of the new and triumphant arch to which we passed to freedom. You'll see in the back of the book a picture of the arch with the various references to the arch that's being built and the foundation. Now, page 63, and I'm just doing it in time. I'm just amazed. When we sincerely took such a position, 4 to 12, not 3, 4 to 12, because it's the steps that give us this. All sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer, and we don't get our job description until we recover. On page 77, our real purpose in life is to be of maximum usefulness to others. Page 102, may have misquoted that, but page 102, your job now is to be at the place where you may be of maximum helpfulness to others. We can't perform God's will until we've recovered. The recovery doesn't come at step three. It's only a decision. Being all-powerful, he provided what we needed. If we kept close to him and performed his work well, the steps established in such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves. We became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, as we became conscious of his presence, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, the hereafter. We were reborn. These are the promises of the program, among the promises of the whole program, not of step three. And I'll prove that in a moment. Just skip the prayer. Page 63, right at the bottom. We found it very desirable to take this spiritual step with an understanding person, such as our wife, best friend, or spiritual advisor. So it's good to have another person around to do this with. It's better to meet God alone than with one who might misunderstand. The wording was optional, so long as we expressed the idea of voicing without reservation. This was only a beginning. Though if honestly and humbly felt, an effect, sometimes a very great one was felt at once. Sometimes you'll feel a great effect, but not necessarily. So no promises for step three in particular. Let's say the step three prayer together. We're going to hear about dinner and about lunch, and I've forgotten from whom. Okay, so we'll find, so don't leave your seat when I finish, because you've got to hear the instructions. But let's say step three together. God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help, of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. It's a fascinating prayer. I offer myself to God. To build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, so that I won't need any more? No, so I can better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, so I won't have any difficulties? No, so that victory over them will bear witness to other people of the power, love, and way of life of God. It's the first time in the big book, essentially, that they're talking about the need to give rather than to take. That this whole program is about that. And I just want to point out the bottom page 63. Next, we launched out on a course of vigorous action, the first step of which is a personal house cleaning. They go on page 64. Though our decision, step three, was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and to be rid of the things in our life which had been blocking us from God, our deepest values. So step three is not a big thing in the big book. It is a prayer, but the forward to the prayer is discussing the whole result of what the steps are about, getting rid of our wish to be in charge and leaving it to our higher power to be in charge.